If you know me a little bit, you'll know I'm a sports fan. I like almost every sport except for soccer. But in particular, I'm an AFL fan. I love the courage and skill mix required to play AFL. I want to introduce you to a player who plays for St Kilda. Here he is on the screen. This is Brendan Goddard. Brendan played in the grand final 2 months ago, St Kilda versus Geelong. One thing that really hit me during the game was the extent to which players were willing to play on through injuries for the sake of winning that game. I want to show you a picture of him after the game. When the camera kept panning onto his face, I had to look away. I couldn't bear to look at his face. His nose is bent off way to the right, just being held on by some sports tape. It came out in the news the next day that he actually suffered a broken nose, broken cheekbone and broken collarbone during the game. When asked by a reporter, "How do you feel about that?" he said, "That's the price you pay." The price you pay for what? For trying to win a game of footy, running around kicking a leather ball for 44 other guys? I wonder if he would have been willing to go that far if it meant that for the next 5 years he was having facial surgery because of his broken face. If he could never pick his kids up again and give them a piggyback because of his shoulder. How far would he be willing to go to win that footy match? What if it cost him his life? Was it still worth putting everything in to win that footy match? Well, I wonder for us, can you think of something that's so important to you that it's worth suffering a broken cheekbone, a broken nose, a broken collarbone? Can you think of anything that's so important to you that it's worth dying for? Well, today we come to a passage where Jesus talks about what it looks like to be his follower. And he makes it sound like it's painful. More painful than having a broken nose, a broken cheekbone and a broken collarbone. Let's come to have a look at our passage tonight, Mark chapter 8, and we're going to start at verse 34. Verse 34. Then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." Jesus explains really clearly what is required of someone if they are to follow him. He says, to come after him, you must deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow him. And note that Jesus doesn't say, well, look, in an ideal world, you might consider the idea of denying yourself. No, he says, you must deny yourself and take up your cross. But what does this look like? Well, when I think of denying myself or think of people denying themselves, I think of the 40-hour famine. People, 40 hours, give up food. It's hard work, I tell you. 40 hours, no food. Or what about monks? They head off into the desert, isolate themselves from anything and everyone that might cause them to stumble. But Jesus doesn't say to deny something to ourselves. He says we are to deny ourselves. But what about ourselves we're supposed to deny? Well, I think it's to do with our selfishness and our tendency to keep looking inwardly. Ever since Adam and Eve chose to reject God back in the garden, our fallen nature has been battling against God's plan. We want a comfortable life. I want to come alongside Jesus, put my arm around him, and negotiate how life's going to work out, you know, to make sure I have a nice, comfortable life the way I want it. But in doing this, all we do is think about ourselves to the exclusion of other people, and more importantly, God. Frank Retief, the Anglican minister in Cape Town, tells a story about one of his congregation members. He was a storeman at the local business down the road. One day his boss came to him and said, "I want you to do something corrupt." This man refused and said, "No, I won't do that," and lost his job there and then, on the spot. Well, that's not the end of the world. But he went 4 years without work. He had a family to support and couldn't find another job in Cape Town. The church were great at helping look after the family, and after 4 years they decided to move to Johannesburg to find a new job, and he did. He found another job as a storeman. In his first week at work, his new boss came to him and asked him to do something corrupt. What does he do? Does he try and slip one past the authorities, get on with his job? What does he refuse? He did. He refused and lost his job there and then, risking another 3 or 4 years of unemployment. Most of us haven't been in that same situation, but our self-interest is fueled by the opposite, the huge number of opportunities we have. Usually extends into wanting notoriety. We want to be noticed. We want to be special. We want to be recognised as someone significant. We want to make a difference, as long as everyone else sees me making a difference. As Jesus puts it, we want to gain the whole world. But Jesus says if we're to come after him, we must deny these desires. We must not only ignore them, we need to kill off that tendency to look to our own self-interests. And he says we should be willing to do it to the point of death. I don't know what imagery is raised in your mind when you read Jesus say that we ought to take up our cross. But in the first century, it was the condemned and despised criminals that took up their cross. Carrying your cross was a public spectacle. You picked it up, you carried it towards the place of execution, and everyone looked down on you. They sneered, they judged you, they watched you receive what you deserved. Jesus is saying that to follow him, you need to join the ranks of the despised and the rejected. You must be willing to deny yourself to the point of being willing to die for the sake of Jesus. Well, for me, there's a really big question at the front of my head right now, and that is, why would I follow Jesus if it costs that much? Why would you? I think the answer is wrapped up, and believe it or not, I think there is an answer in the passage. It's wrapped up in Jesus' identity. As we read through Mark's Gospel, the question of Jesus' identity continually pops its head up. In fact, in chapter 4, the disciples themselves ask that exact question after Jesus calms the storm. They say, "Who is this, that even the wind and the waves obey him?" Well, the question's been brewing for 8 chapters, and we're going to try and get an answer. So let's come to verse 27 of chapter 8. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "The Christ." Well, the topic's raised by Jesus himself. He asked his disciples, "Who do people say I am?" Have you ever tried that? Have you ever walked along, turned to your friend and said, "Oh, who do people say I am?" I'd love to know what answers you get. Let me know later. It's a bit of an outrageous question, isn't it, at one level? But at this point, it's not so outrageous because people have been speculating about who Jesus is. Some people say he's John the Baptist. Some say he's Elijah. Some say he's a prophet from God. But that in itself is significant because there hasn't been a prophet from God for over 400 years. So to think that all of a sudden here is someone that God has sent is actually really significant. But Jesus doesn't leave the question out there, "Who do others say I am?" He says to the disciples, "Who do you say I am?" Peter says, "You're the Christ." This declaration by Peter is significant because until now, the disciples have called Jesus nothing more than teacher. But to understand that Jesus is the Christ, it's a very different story. Because in passages like 2 Samuel 7, God promises that he will raise up a king. A king, a descendant of King David, but a king whose kingdom will be established forever. And if you read that promise, like the first century Jews did, with a slight short-sightedness, then actually what you were expecting was a king to come and to re-establish the kingdom of Israel, to overthrow the Roman Empire who were ruling and to re-establish Israel as the great nation they were under King David. And with that in mind, Peter has just identified that this man Jesus, is that long-awaited Messiah. Are you familiar with the idea of a Messiah? I think our culture still has it sometimes. Barack Obama, a lot of people see as the Messiah for the United States, the one who's going to come in and clean up the Congress. Channel 9 have one, he's called Eddie Maguire. Every time the ratings dip off, bring out a new show, whack Eddie up there, fix the problem. Freo Dockers tried a few. They had Crowe, Pavlich, Bell, Headland, Farmer, Solomon, Harvey. None of them worked. When we read tonight's passage and we understand that the person speaking is the promised Messiah, We need to sit up and take notice. This is God's promised king. This king actually gave a glimpse of his glory to the three disciples. We read about it in chapter 9. If you come to verse 2, we read about 6 days later, Jesus taking Peter, James and John with him and leading them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone could ever bleach them. What were the disciples supposed to make of these events? Well, Peter tells us in his second letter that he, James and John, were eyewitnesses of Jesus' majesty when they were with him on the sacred mountain. These three disciples saw a glimpse of the glory of Jesus. This glory was made known in a much bigger way when Jesus rose from the dead, defeating death, when he ascended to heaven to be seated at God's right hand. The disciples got a preview of that. They got to see it in advance. When we hear Jesus speak, do we think of it as the King speaking? Do you think of it as our King speaking? Well, it's worth noting this was actually a really big problem for the disciples too. There seemed to be a conflict between what they expected and what Jesus was revealing. You see it clearly in verse 29 where Peter says, "You are the Christ." And three verses later, he's rebuking Jesus for his claim that he's going to die. Have you had that experience? Experience of how on earth could someone be correcting you? I sat at university lectures for 4.5 years and often sit in the back row pretending to pay attention. This person down the front, and they were paying way too much attention for a first year uni lecture, and they listened to everything the lecturer said, and they'd pipe up, "Excuse me, sir, you got that wrong." What? This lecturer has been doing it 10, 20, 30 years. They're usually a professor in the field. And this little 20-year-old kid, fresh from school, "Excuse me, sir, that's all wrong." I love watching him get shot down. It was great to watch. No one likes to smile. And here is Peter. He's just identified, this is the king. This is God's promised Messiah. "Oh, but Jesus, you've got it all wrong, mate. No one's going to listen to you if you start talking like that." Things haven't clicked for Peter yet. On one hand, he's the Messiah. On the other hand, he's got it wrong. And in this context, the mountain experience does something else for us. And it is something else for the disciples. If you look at verse 7 of chapter 9, "A cloud appeared and enveloped them, and a voice came from the cloud, 'This is my son whom I love. Listen to him.' Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus." God appeared on the mountain and he spoke. And he said to Peter, James and John, "Do you know who this is? Listen to him. This is my son." And if you trace back the chapters preceding this in Mark, you'll find out that's been the problem. The disciples haven't been listening to Jesus. And it takes God to appear to them on a mountain to tell them to wake up and listen. Jesus is the one with the authority to speak. He is the navigator. He is the professor. He is the king. But there's another big question in my mind, and that is, why does following Jesus look like this? Understanding who Jesus is and the authority with which he speaks, we come back to where we started. "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." But why does it involve self-denial? Well, it seems that it's all wrapped up in Jesus' mission. Just prior to the verses we've read, Jesus is teaching his disciples. Have a look at verse 31, chapter 8. "Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again." He spoke plainly about this. Jesus explains his mission. The greatness of the Messiah isn't revealed by his military force. His greatness is revealed through his willingness to suffer and die for the sake of others. God's will for his son was for him to die, to bring people back into a relationship with him. Jesus didn't want to die. The thought actually really troubled him. But he was willing to die. He was willing to submit to his father's plan for our sake. This plan was carried out by people that needed him most. It was Jesus who was rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law. But what about us? How does that affect us here 2,000 years later? Well, Jesus gives us this warning when he speaks in John chapter 15. If the world hates you, remember that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. This world, our instinctive thinking, the wisdom all around us, is opposed to Jesus and his lordship. Jesus says to us, if you follow me, you should expect to be laughed at. You could think about it like this. If Bill Gates happened to walk into this room and go to each one of us, I want to give you $1 million each. That $1 million is a free gift. Do with it what you like. But there's a warning. Some people hate me, and if you take the money, if you take the gift, you're going to be associated with me, and they'll hate you too. Well, Jesus calls his followers not to be ashamed of him. Look at verse 35 of chapter 8. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and the sake of the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. Was it likely that the disciples were going to be ashamed? Yeah, I think that's exactly what Peter was doing. He loved the idea of following Jesus when he was this great military ruler and Peter was going to be his right-hand man. But as soon as death, suffering came into it, whoa, no one's going to follow a fruitcake like you. Whoa, no. But Jesus calls us to follow him knowing the cost, knowing exactly what it will look like. And he urges us to keep in mind eternity, life that is everlasting. In the light of eternity, what good is it to gain this whole world but end up destroyed? For you and me, the temptation is that we are ashamed of Jesus. I wonder if you think for a moment, what is it that might make you tempted to be ashamed of Jesus? What sort of thing can get in the way of you following Jesus? For me, I think it's relationships and popularity. I want to be liked. I want people to think I'm capable, funny, strong, worth hanging out with. And I justify that really easily because if people get on well with me, then they're going to be receptive to me telling them about Jesus. So of course it's a great thing to be well liked. But at its heart, it's my insecurity that he's speaking. I want comfort and stability in this world, and I want people to think I'm great, a great engineer, a great Bible teacher, a great musician. The list goes on. What is it for you? What is it that gets in the way of trusting Jesus? Even if you could gain the whole world, even if we made it to the top, what would it be if we're doomed to death in the life to come? In following Jesus, people will make fun of you. They're going to tell you that you're a loser. By God's grace, most of us won't face death, although some of us might. But following Jesus involves being willing to die for his sake, and we can do so in full confidence that he will give life everlasting. So I want to ask you how you react when you're thinking conflict is in conflict with what Jesus says. What do you do when you're really keen on a non-Christian guy and Jesus says, don't do it? How do you react when you see your peers building their dream home, everything they need, everything they want? Or you see your peers spending all their money travelling the world year after year? Do you go along with the conversations in the lunchroom? You know, the ones where Christians really psychologically need help and they love to have something to trust in, so, yeah, Christianity is really helpful for them. They're actually really hypocritical, but I'm glad they found something to give them some hope. Do you go along with that? Or do you speak up? Jesus is calling us to make a decision. He calls us to decide to follow him. And if you decide to follow him, he calls you to decide to keep following him. you think back to the start, I introduced Brendan Goddard to you. I assume at the beginning of the grand final, he decided he was going to give everything he had to win that game with his team. But at halftime, when he had a broken face, broken collarbone, he had to reassess that decision. Was he going to keep going out there, keep taking risks for the sake of winning that game? Jesus doesn't want to deceive any of us, and nor do I. Jesus doesn't say, and he never did say, that if you follow me, life will be fine and dandy. Your marks will get better, sickness won't trouble you, everyone will admire your witty personality, and your bank balance will always stay great. He didn't say it. Instead, he says that following the Messiah, following God's King, will often involve denying your own self-interest. Many people in this world will think you're weak. Some will hate you, just as they hated him. But Jesus calls us to choose to follow his path, not to be ashamed of him and his words. And Jesus promises to those that follow him a life that will be spectacular, will be so much greater than the one we have now. So I simply want to ask, have you chosen to follow Jesus? And if you have, will you continue to choose to follow him, knowing full well what the cost is?